I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Jeff Hutchison. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello, Michael. Very nice to be here.
Well, Jeff, you've had a varied career in the media. You've sent reports back from all parts of the world, Europe, North America, around the country. You're known in various guises, but to people around Frio, most recently in your role as the person bringing us the morning program on ABC 720 Perth.
Yeah, and then I decided, I worked on the drive program after that, and then I decided I'd done enough talking and I wanted to do some writing.
And you have. And I'm holding a book authored by Jeff Hutchison, How Not to Become a Grumpy Old Bugger. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I've just got one question immediately for you, why you took this sort of self-portrait and used it on the front cover.
Well, the interesting thing about that poor fellow on the front cover is he's a stock shot. He's referred to as a stock shot, an almost generic, unhappy-looking older gentleman. But everyone's looking at the book going, who is he? I think I know him. With my luck, he'll end up being a World War II hero who did incredibly brave things and will then be sued by his family. But it's a nice cover. It pops. It looks like it's a comedic book, but I did ask the publisher to add the line, A Bloke's Guide to Living a Better Life, because it's more serious than that.
Well, Jeff, if I were starting this interview again, I would have foregone all of the opening words. I would simply have said to you, Jeff, are you content?
I am, but I think I work on being content. And I talk in the book in latter stages about people and their pursuit of happiness, and I've always found happiness to be an episodic idea. And I used to have a segment on the wireless called Who Are You? And I would finish every segment by asking my guest, were they happy? And I didn't find it a very authentic question, and certainly people didn't answer it comfortably. So I asked them if they were content, and that gave them more room to be more effusive in their responses. And so I'm a big believer in seeking contentment rather than some kind of definition of happiness.
You've had me puzzling over the two questions, are you happy versus are you content? And what you've just explained, I think, works for me. It might depend on the time of the day. If you ask me during the daylight hours, am I content? I think I can easily enough respond to that and think positively, and yes, I am. If you ask people if they're happy in the evening, perhaps into the middle evening later even, you might get a range of different answers.
You would, because that range of answers has come from, it's like a how are you feeling now question, rather than how do you assess your whole experience. So one of my motivations for writing the book was that I actually asked my dad, as a 12-year-old.
A 12-year-old?
Yeah, I asked him if he was happy.
You asked your father when you were 12 if he was happy?
Yeah.
That's a very, well, intuitive, sort of pre-pubescent sort of...
It came from nowhere. And the curious thing was that he looked away and then looked back at me and said, no, not really, and then went off to water his tomatoes.
Now, isn't that really an astonishing response to his 12-year-old son's question? Because he could have just ignored you and said, see you later, Jeff, go and kick a football or something.
Yeah.
But instead he answered you, and that sounds like a meaningful answer.
Isn't it funny? At the time, it didn't mean a lot to me, and it certainly didn't trouble me. I was a pretty chirpy kind of kid, so I thought that was Dad being Dad. But when I finished up working at the ABC, and certainly when Dad was at the end of his life, I came to reflect on his life more. And he hadn't had a particularly happy time. And he had been a pretty grumpy sort of chap at different points. And when I reflected on the answer, when I was much closer in age to him as he was at the time, I really quite admired that he told me the truth. No explanation, but he told me the truth. And it was probably as close as I could get to my dad saying, this is how I reflect on my life. So he's one of the reasons for writing the book. The other is, of course, you know, apart from people like yourself, Michael, I think a lot of blokes, when they get to a certain age or have finished their work careers, or the nature of family has changed, or you're now living in an empty house, there is a tendency for Australian men and their world to become smaller, inward looking, and I don't like the idea of blokes having a thwarted worldview, because we've run the show forever, and to feel sorry for ourselves, I think, is wasting an opportunity to know that there actually is another role to play, and that is the role of someone who has a great deal of accumulated experience and wisdom, and you can apply those things in really good and kind ways. I would suggest that you try and do it without judgment or correction or the need to be right all the time. But that's the essence of the book. In fact, 288 pages is distilled into go easy on yourself and go easy on other people.
And I like that theme, which comes up early in the book. The book truly seems to be in two halves, a bit like a rugby match, I suppose. But in the first part, you had me reflecting about things which I've tried to improve on in the last few days. For example, in the car, when someone cuts in front of you, or they're at the lights and they seem to be looking at their phone and they don't move when the lights have gone green, and you either hit the horn or you pull back from doing so. So you'll be pleased to hear I pull back from doing so. I think, why am I getting fussed? I think I've done that myself before. But you pick up on a range of frustrations that men in particular seem to evince.
Well, that was part of the fun. I mean, I don't want people to think that this book is without its humour. And you are allowed to be grumpy. You really are allowed to be grumpy. So I had great fun accumulating lists of things that make people grumpy. And I had one reader, this is early days, so I've had very little feedback on the book so far. And one bloke has written to me to say, everything you wrote in chapter two, I felt angry about. And I thought, that's really a lot of accumulated grumpiness. And my argument there is, we often get grumpy about things that barely matter to us. And if we accumulate these grievances, we will end up with this big metaphorical pothole outside the front of our house. And every day we will go there waiting for the bloody council to fill the pothole. And when they don't fill it, we'll say to our partner, oh, I said they haven't filled the bloody pothole. That'd be right. That's typical. And we curate, and I use this phrase, and I've used it on ABC Radio because it's a bit rude. We curate this museum of dickheadedness where we accumulate all these grievances. The problem is they don't make us happier, and they just sit in our guts, and they churn away, and they make us miserable, and they make us miserable to be around. So the book really invites blokes to step outside themselves for a minute and think about how their behaviour is impacting on their partner, their kids, and are the grandkids coming over for a sleepover anymore? And if they're not, is it because they're scared of how you are presenting yourself to the world?
Jeff, I listen to you when you're on both the morning programme, less so on the afternoon programme, because I was usually hard at work. And I've heard you talk on a number of occasions. It strikes me that you've always been a fairly intuitive person. I suspect one way or the other you'd picked up on your father when you asked him that question as a 12-year-old. And on the radio you had that way of getting a little bit, not so much under people's skin, but sort of under their guard and ask them questions that matter. Was there a point in your life when you realised or thought you needed to overcome the propensity to be a grumpy young bugger?
I think the thing that I had that I'm glad to have shared, I used to like being cynical and funny. It went well with journalism. You know, no one's going to pull the wool over my eyes. I can look at that. You know, I can reveal that flaw or that dishonesty, and I thought that would set me up nicely. But as I got older, very much come to the view that I dislike cynicism. It is self-serving, so you enjoy it for a period of time. But as Billy Bragg and many others have said, it is the enemy of hope. So if you become too cynical, here we go again, the council still haven't filled in the pothole, when's that going to happen? You'll continue with that sort of broad mindset. That means the next time someone comes to you with an idea for something, you'll immediately discount its merits. It's like going on Fremantle Massive and reading some of the comments on Fremantle Massive, where they are invariably written by men with not much else on their minds, and they are enormously negative.
So this book, in so many ways, probably in every way, is meant to be an antidote to what you just described.
I hope so.
Now, can a woman read it, or is that just for her to confirm the fact that her partner or friend or father or brother or children, who are all male, are the way they are?
I hope women buy it. When I've talked to women about me writing this book, they have nodded their heads furiously. And this is one of the lessons I think we blokes need to be really aware of. And I speak to Maggie Dent, who is a wonderful authority on these matters too. And she says, when women get past menopause and putting food on the table for the kids, they're going to want to go and do things. And you'll be left sitting at the formica table saying, Beryl, where's my tea? And Beryl will be off hot air ballooning in Turkey. And I bet you she invited you to come, but you chose not to because you just couldn't really be bothered. So we have to be very aware that as we get older, we think we are going to fade and opportunity and curiosity is going to disappear. But our partners do want to do other things. And the grey divorce rate in this country is about the only demographic where divorce is rising in this country, where women, if they are financially able, are looking at their partners going, I don't know that I need another 20 years of this. So how's that for a little warning, chaps? A little air raid siren going off?
I was at a conference many years ago, well, not that many years ago, Jeff, really, when Ian Callinan, former High Court judge who just retired, told a sort of few funnies at the time. But the one that stayed with me was, he said, my wife has said to me, Ian, now that you're retired, to let you know two things. You're not to ask me what time I'll be home tonight, nor are you to ask me what we're having for lunch today.
Yeah.
And there really is something in that, isn't there?
There really is. And it, because, you know, when my dad retired from work, he wanted my mum to stop working at the same time, which she duly did.
Did she? Yeah. Really?
And she loved work. It was so important to her. And she spent years walking on eggshells dealing with my father's sensitivity. I can say very positively, in the latter years of his life, Dad got fed up with being fed up. We'd moved back to Perth, a couple of grandkids about the place, and he found a happier version of himself. And right at the very end of the book, I make mention of a time in my life, many years after asking that question, where I really needed my dad, and he was there for me in a very meaningful way. And that's probably the strongest message I want to get out there to blokes. Don't think that as you get older, there is not an important contribution for you to make in the life of your family, but also your community. It just will require you to be a slightly different version of who you were before.
You made a comment earlier about men having been in charge of everything. Is that the simple explanation or an important explanation for why men get grumpy later? Is it something about men that you've discovered in the course of researching and writing this book that in a sense should give us no hope that men can improve? Is there something different between the genders that explains the apparent contentedness, if you like, of women, even if they keep it hidden?
Yeah, I think if men have not seen these changes, some of these changes coming, then we really haven't been looking. So if we're talking about generations of women moving into the workforce, women wanting to have careers, women assuming senior positions, women now being seen as decision makers of significance, if blokes haven't noticed that there was going to be a slight change to the idea of who's going to be cooking dinner, you know, generationally, you know, I look at my kids and they're both, and my son-in-law, they're both professionals, they both work. Whoever gets home first cooks the evening meal. And that it is a true partnership. And the definition of the roles have changed a bit. I think the best response to it is to not be grim about it and not be surly about it, because we have been beneficiaries of so many things for such a long time. It's almost like an invitation to, can you let someone else have a go on the swing? Or can someone else have a piece of that cake? And truly, we almost have this reflex that wants to fight against those things. And I think we would be better if we could calm that reflex and realize that by sharing opportunity and sharing space, we lose nothing.
Jeff, I suggested in a very broad sense that the book is in two halves, and learning to be calm and take that approach you've just described sort of permeates the first half of the book. But then you seem to have invited in some people. Well, you have invited in some people to contribute actual chapters to reflect on things that are obviously going to be important as you get older. Mm. For example, you have Nick Bruning coming along, who you used to interview on part of your radio program, talking about retirement.
Yeah.
Now, that's a really interesting prospect, because I know from experience that some of my colleagues were worried about retirement. Some people worry they're not going to have enough money, or mostly worry they're not going to know what to do.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting contribution to the book.
Well, you know, lots of people write books about retirement or how to look after your money when you're no longer in the workplace. This is really a series of little essays, I think, that you can dip in and out of. I have to convince myself that I can get blokes to read the entire book, but I'm not sure that they will. You know, I had to get the tone right, because sometimes I'm gentle, sometimes I point the finger fairly sharply. If blokes can get so defensive so quickly, they can see things as an accusation when you might be suggesting, this isn't an accusation, this is an invitation to think differently if you're in the mood to. We talk about retirement. It does get more serious when I talk about issues of violence and again, what I think are a role and responsibility that men can play in that area today, and that's by speaking up and making sure their boys and their grandsons understand the responsibilities that come with being a bloke. We talk about going to the doctor. We talk about living with regret. And that was a really interesting one. And the chapter about listening.
The chapter about listening is probably the most important one I've discovered in life. And you probably learnt this as a young bloke, as a journalist. Everyone should do journalism first. The art of journalism, I think, is listening.
I would imagine in your career you have been a very careful listener. And I sort of learnt over 16 years of being on the radio every day what being a careful listener actually meant. And I think it's, you know, I ask blokes in this book, another one of them, I ask them to do a lot of things, but one of them is to do a little audit of some conversations they have. And what were they like in that conversation? Did they barge in? Were they loud? Did you talk over the top of someone? If someone said something to you, did you have a question for them that might invite them to expand on what they were saying? And I used to do that professionally. I used to have those audits, which I really hated doing. But they are enormously important to me, and they just taught me to give space for other people. And, you know, it probably does go back to me asking Dad as a 12-year-old, are you happy, Dad? I was curious. I'm not sure I was concerned. I think I was just curious about a fellow who was a good dad and a loving dad, but in many ways was quite closed. And I wanted to get some insight into why he was so closed. And, you know, I point out in the book some of the things I didn't learn until he was 82 years of age and chose to tell me something that had happened to him when he was a boy.
Jeff, amongst the contributions, and I have to say a stunning contribution, is a chapter by your son. It might be the standout part of the book.
I don't think so. It might be the second worst part of the book, I think, because I now have to pass this information on to Hugh. The editor, I think, intuitively knew that Hugh's really a smart kid and a good writer. And he said, I'd like to get a chapter from your son about how a 28-year-old perceives the male world. And he has written really interestingly about what it was like for him to move to Melbourne, to pull his life together there, to talk about loneliness, to talk about the absence of a friendship group. He goes pretty hard, and I think pretty fairly, on a generation that I think does feel rather too sorry for itself and is very quick to find fault in a younger generation. But I will, you know, with gritted teeth, tell him, Michael, that you thought his chapter was excellent. Look, I'm very proud of him. He's a great boy, and I just wish he lived a bit closer, frankly.
Well, that's the son, but I started to feel sorry, sort of in the mother-in-law vein of jokes, for the son-in-law. Son-in-laws in the book seem to figure in sort of dastardly activities and things.
Well, this book looks like it's aimed at blokes who are 60 and older. I think, and I know I get to sell it now in a way that I never get to sell things at the ABC, so I'm far more enthusiastic about buy it now. But I think there's something a 40-year-old bloke can read in there and look at and might see a bit of his dad, or might be thinking, yeah, you know, I don't want to do that. And, you know, a couple of months ago, we were going for our walk down at South Beach, and I saw it. I almost couldn't believe it. I saw this little running club of dads with prams. There are about eight of them running with kids in prams. And I looked at that and I thought, it's going to be all right. Truly, generationally, I think we are allowing a new generation of men to live less prescriptive and prescribed lives. So when I make observations about blokes in this book, I do so knowing that most of them and us were brought up a very certain way, wore an often very chafing uniform of male expectation, and were told how this is how a man behaves. Now, I do think there's an opportunity for other generations to not live such prescriptive lives, but also there's an opportunity for us to take off that, at any age, to take off that straitjacket and see if there's something else that fits us a bit more comfortably.
Now, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about the business side of this. Got a book out, just refer to the fact that nice to get it out there, buy it now. I think people are going to, particularly when they hear you talking about what you're trying to achieve in it, because it does have humour, it makes me laugh out loud at times. I like the sort of curated, careful use of the F word, which suddenly jumps out. And you keep your eye on the ball most of the time. You don't lose the plot yourself. And you've indicated, but I think it's worth again just saying, is there an order to the people you'd like to read it? Do you start with people like me who have made it to the age of 75? You looking at the over 60s? You're wanting the 28-year-olds of the world to read it?
You know, the publisher said it's to come out as a Father's Day book. And they told me that Father's Day, behind Christmas, is the biggest book-selling day in Australia, which may seem strange, but that's often people buying books for dad because they don't know what else to get him.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
It's exactly.
Perception that blokes are really hard to buy for unless you're getting them a Bunnings voucher.
Well, my son has solved that problem. He gives me books he wants to read, which would be a good idea. We should all read this book.
So, look, I think there is something of value in it, but the exciting and slightly nervous thing for me at the moment is I'm waiting for the feedback. I'm getting, you know, I've been on some lovely podcasts, some nice pieces in The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. It seems to be selling well, but you know, I don't know what that means. I'm a journalist, I'm not in the publishing business. It seems to be going well and might have a bit of longevity about it. I'd like to talk publicly off the back of it. I think in between writing something else, I'd like to go and talk to groups of men about it. I'd like to tease them, I'd like to tussle their hair, and I like to tell them that, you know, there are things you can do, there are easy things you can do to find that contentment that I'm talking about.
Excuse me. I think that's a great way forward. We have audiobooks these days. What are you doing anything in that regard?
Yeah, I have. I've already read the audiobook.
You've read it?
Well, I've read it, yeah.
Now, that will be interesting.
Well, that'll be fun. And it took me, it comes in at 487 minutes. It took me nearly 16 hours to read, and I took great delight when I saw Hugh a few weeks ago in Melbourne to say that his chapter was the hardest to read, because obviously I've written everything else. And I write in a conversational tone, and I write quite short sentences because I don't want blokes to get bored. So then I got to Hugh's, you know, sophisticated chapter, and had to, you know, just about sound out the words, they were so big. But that was really fun. And I think that's another way of saying, listen, put your earbuds in and have a listen. And if you don't like that bit, go to the next bit, because I think there might be something there.
Jeff, we'll bring this podcast discussion to a close, but I want to congratulate you, A, for being brave enough, really, to write a book like this, because people could say, whoever wrote a book like this, oh, here's some guy trying to be New Age.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to read that. I know all about life. And for having written it and for having made it so readable, and the more I got into it, the more I liked it. It's not meant to be a manual for how to live your life, but in some ways it is. And I think for people who are getting that little bit older, it does make you stop and think about how you're living your life and the years that lie ahead. What do you want them to be like?
Well, you know, as I make the observation, and there's a chapter on death and things like that as well, and you know, we don't know whether we're here for another 25 years or I'll have an aneurysm and fall into my crunchy nut cornflakes tomorrow morning. So there are some things we can do to feel empowered at a time when we think we are losing a lot of those things. So, yeah, I hope people like it, Michael.
Well, a couple who have already liked it, and I shall tell our listeners about, one is Dr. Norman Swan, ABC Health guy who covers everything, but he says of your book, life's too short to be a grump. This will lighten you up. And it does. And it, there are parts where you smile and say, yes, I'll stop being a grump, and it's a good reference point. But the one I like is Ian Chappell, the former Australian test captain, who at various times is a bit of a grump himself when he's used to be calling the cricket. But he says, interesting, witty and thought-provoking. Well, I think on that basis, everyone should run out and buy it, Jeff.
Well, Ian is a friend of mine, and I've known him for a very long time. I was hoping he would give me a quote that said, I have no interest in reading this book. But he read it sincerely and liked it. So, no, I was very very flattered.
And to get that gender balance right, and you've already made references to Maggie Dent, she endorses it by saying, How Not to Become a Grumpy Old Bugger is a book the world needed. It's written about men, for men, by a man who's a truth seeker. It's blunt, raw, real, funny, and frankly, it has the potential not only to enhance men's lives as they age and improve marriages, it could save lives. Wow, that's something.
When I was sent that quote, I looked through the book and I wondered where I'd written those chapters. No, that's terrific. And you know, we'll see. You know, you can look at me now, I'm just sitting here with my hands sort of gripped in this kind of, yep, I'll just wait and see whether people like it or not. If it makes a tiny bit of difference to someone's life, then it will have served a purpose.
Well, it's out there. It's getting a life of its own. You're talking about it around the country. And I hope lots of people buy it for Father's Day, Jeff. Jeff, congratulations.
Thank you, Michael.